Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. On today's show, we are discussing media coverage of Afghanistan and the so-called FISA memo. The White House, just about an hour ago, declassified a memo in which Republicans accused the Department of Justice and the FBI of bias in the early stages of the Russia investigation. According to reports, the House Intelligence Committee first gave the memo to Fox and the Washington Examiner. So we're going to talk about coverage of this. It's getting nonstop coverage. But what is the real story here? We are kicking off today's show by talking about the violence in Afghanistan. More than 16 years after the United States invaded Afghanistan, 15,000 U.S. soldiers are still on the ground. The United States has spent over $1 trillion, and the violence continues. Recent ISIS and Taliban suicide bombings killed at least 150 Afghans. So what explains this? Today, we are joined by Ali Latifi. He is a freelance journalist based in Kabul, Afghanistan. Hi, Ali. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us, Ali. We're also joined by John Nichols, National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation magazine and author of many books, including Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. We had John on to talk about that when it came out a couple of months ago. Hi, John. Welcome back to the show. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you both.
Great to have you both. Well, as we always do on Friday's Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that's stood out this week. John Nichols, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, there's a tremendous piece that was done. You know, it's Black History Month, right? And so there's a lot of articles related to Black history and African-American history in the United States. And I always think that's an important thing because it's one of the rare moments where American media goes deeper on some issues. But it's also disappointing in that it's only a month a year, and so it cuts both ways. So I always look around to see if somebody's doing something genuinely interesting. And I found a tremendous piece, tremendous bit of work done by Mona Chalabi at The Guardian. It came out Thursday. It's The Geography of Black America, Then and Now. And almost 100 years after Carter Woodson had the idea of Black History Month, Mona Chalabi examines the geography of Black America. And it's a really remarkable combination of data and, you know, some good writing as well. Just a terrific piece, and you can find it over at the Guardian's website. Again, The Geography of Black America, Then and Now. Lots of information about where people live, what their circumstance is, and basically changes in America, physical changes in America, going back 100 years, but also so many things that haven't changed. So I just think it's a terrific piece.
Yeah, I'm just checking it out right now. It looks like a great piece. We will link to that right after the show. That is John Nichols, National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation magazine. Ali Latifi, you are in Kabul, and I'm sure that you're just focused specifically on what's happening in Afghanistan. But what caught your attention this week? Where are you seeing good reporting?
So there was a story in the LA Times this week. It's about like the recent attacks and what's going on and what's happening. But the most interesting part was in the end, there was an interview with a 19-year-old student, and he says that he carries around a little piece of paper in his pocket with like phone numbers in case anything happens to him. And the interesting thing is when I was talking about this piece with the author, I was actually, there was a friend of ours who's in the government who has children himself, and he said, "Oh, that's a great idea. We should start doing that." So it sort of shows, you know, really because he was also saying that there are 8 bodies that have gone unclaimed so far that are unidentifiable, and so it just sort of shows, you know, that people are preparing literally for the worst, you know, and like as you guys said earlier in the intro, it's what 16, 17 years into the war, and people still have to take precautions like this.
Well, Ali, let's start off and talk about how people are doing. At least 150 people have been killed. In the last couple of weeks, there have been a series of suicide bombings by ISIS and Taliban forces. The photos and the videos coming out have been horrific. There's been a bloodied photo of a young woman in a Kabul marketplace recently captured. I mean, what is the mood in the city? You're in Kabul right now. What are you hearing from people?
There's obviously fear, you know, that's a given. And the thing is, like, in the last week, we've all received so many reports of, oh, be careful of this area, be careful of that area, there's a threat. And it's funny, because we were all joking. We're like, essentially, parentheses, it should just say all of Kabul. So that's definitely, you know, a sense of... The fear has heightened, obviously, at the moment. And then you also have the issue of people's frustration, because they feel like, well, then what is the answer? You know, for instance, yesterday there was a protest, a small protest, calling for the government to step down, and I asked a few other people in other neighborhoods of the city, and they were like, well, what is that really going to accomplish? Because who are you going to put in their place? But there's definitely a frustration and the sense of, okay, who's going to fix it? How is it going to get better? Because at the end of, like, we're seeing, you know, for instance, Resolute Support, the international coalition here, the international military coalition here, said that they killed 1,600 Daesh fighters, right, in the last year. So if they killed 1,600, then how are they able to stage these attacks in these last two weeks in Kabul and in Jalalabad? So there's all these questions, you know. It's sort of... The violence goes in waves, obviously, and this is probably among the worst these last 10 days. With those waves come the same sort of emotions, and it's always fear and frustration.
John Nichols, this week the BBC released an investigation showing that the Taliban are now in full control of 14 districts in Afghanistan, that's about 4% of the country, and have an active and open physical presence in 263 districts. That's 66% of the country. And yet, the United States, as it always does, not just under Donald Trump, is claiming that this war against the Taliban is going well. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, look, we're now 17 years into, or the better part of 17 years, into a war that, from the start, our political leaders suggested would be perhaps painful. They weren't completely dishonest about it, but they essentially suggested it would be easy, a confrontation of a high-tech, modern U.S. military with a backward, underdeveloped military on the other side. And, you know, it's the same thing that they did in Vietnam. It's the same thing that they've done again and again in countries around the world. And what U.S. policymakers always misjudge, get wrong, is an assumption that they're fighting a traditional war like World War II or even the Civil War, whatever, but something that goes along lines they understand. A guerrilla war, or what was a guerrilla war, now has developed into something that is much more structured. It doesn't play by those rules. And so we've had this constant process through President George W. Bush, through President Barack Obama, now through President Trump, of suggesting that, you know, we just have to tinker with it a little bit. It's just around the corner. And most of our media goes along with that. You do have skeptical reports sometimes, and that's, you know, terrific. 60 Minutes did something that was at least somewhat skeptical a couple weeks ago. But at the end of the day, two things come into play, and they're both very important. Number one, our media still tends to be, in too many senses, the media of the 1960s, the media of 2001, 2002, not as skeptical as it should be about U.S. pronouncements as regards war. And then a second thing, which I think is a bigger deal in the United States, most of our media doesn't cover Afghanistan. It's an incredibly downplayed story, not out of any, you know, conspiracy or political calculus, but because our media is so internalized now, so obsessed with what's happening with Donald Trump in Washington. It's not paying much attention to any place in the world, but especially not to Afghanistan. It's undercovered. Most Americans don't know what's going on there. And if they did know more, they would even up the already large portion of the American population that says we should just get out.
Right. And yet there are 15,000 soldiers still on the ground in Afghanistan. The United States has spent over $1 trillion. Ali, one of your latest pieces called Footprints, Heart of Darkness, is in Dawn.com. You have written for the LA Times in the past. You are based in Kabul, as John said, because there's so much attention on Donald Trump and so many bureaus have cut their foreign correspondents. They've gotten rid of their foreign correspondents. What has your experience been like in telling the story from Kabul?
It's very difficult because the fact is that, you know, you really, really have to try to sell a story and to get people interested in it. You know, it's not, unless it's something specifically about Daesh or a very specific aspect of the Taliban. I mean, the thing is, it's not just with Donald Trump. It was even before that, it was very hard to sell a story from there. Yeah. But obviously, under Donald Trump, it's become even more difficult. And for instance, one outlet that I've been working with, they were like, oh, we're focusing a lot on economic policy, but if you have any ideas that have to do with Trump's policies in Afghanistan, then we'll take it. But, you know, a lot of those, it can be a very repetitive story, you know? He's right. My question is always, like, what is the coverage like over there of these incidents, you know? Do people really understand what's going on, what the last 10 days have been like here throughout the country, and how much coverage does it really get?
Yeah, and in fact, what I find is that you have to read a number of stories to try to put the pieces together. So, Ali, you are on the ground in Kabul. Can you give us a sense of what exactly is happening on the ground? I mean, this is big, but the role of the United States, the role of Pakistan, and why the Afghan government cannot provide security for Afghans.
So right now, the situation on the streets, you know, so many roads are blocked, there are police everywhere, but they've really upped the security, and this always happens after attacks. You see, you know, more streets are blocked, there are more police everywhere, people have become, you know, there's much more attention paid to the actual security. And then, of course, the people say, well, like, where was this before, you know? And so that's really the situation at the moment in terms of what it's like on the streets. In terms of the government, you know, these are the questions that people are asking. I don't know the answer, but people are asking, you know, why can't they figure this out? And at the same time, they have their own internal problems. You know, there's a governor in the north who refuses to step down, who says the president can't tell me what to do. You know, saying if I resign, the president and the chief executive have to resign. There's a police commander in the south, a very powerful one, who agrees with him, who's saying the same things. If you put pressure on the governor in the north, then they'll all come after you too. So there's these sorts of issues that the government is dealing with. And then there's also, like, the one thing that everyone in the country can get behind in terms of what Donald Trump is, to get back to the U.S., in terms of what Donald Trump is doing, is his pressure on Pakistan. I don't think you'll find anyone in this country that will have a problem with what he's saying about Pakistan and the idea of terrorist safe havens and things like that. You know, they're saying, like, finally he's saying these things. Finally, a world power, and of any world power, the United States is admitting this on the world stage and is trying to put pressure on Pakistan. Now, of course, the follow-up comment to that is, how do you lead to action beyond that? You know, what are you going to do beyond just the threat, beyond the aid cut? Because what is it, like $1 billion? What does that really mean to the Pakistani budget? But can you really follow through with it and really put the pressure that needs to be put on them to finally end it?
And to go to your point, John Nichols, about the media covering this and then the U.S. government being honest about what is actually happening, I'm reading right now from Foreign Policy. Afghan government forces are struggling to turn the tide against Taliban insurgents, and the military is seeking to block the release of information about the war's progress. In its latest report on the state of the war, the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction wrote that the military had ordered it not to publish a range of data about how much territory is under the control of the Afghan government or insurgents, even though the information is not classified and had previously been released.
That's unsettling, isn't it?
Yes.
Because what you really, I mean, we have to read between the lines. It's not very hard. What it would suggest to you is that this is information that does not provide an encouraging picture, if you will. I think a 10-year-old American kid could tell you that. And so, you know, look, we have a problem, and the problem is multifold. First off, you have a terrific guest with us here today from Afghanistan who is telling us about the the deep details of this, the background of this. And we know that Afghanistan has immense complexity and a long story to tell. For a brief period, the United States had media coverage that, you know, began to explore that story and kind of brought people up to speed. But as this war extended, the media's attention span decayed. It dissipated. At the same time, American media has found it more and more expensive, more and more difficult to cover not just Afghanistan, but countries around the world. The end result is that the military and successive administrations become essentially the dominant narrative as regards what's happening there. The only other narrative is horrific reports of terrible things happening, you know, bombs going off, hundreds of people being killed. There's no middle ground, which is the nuance, the character of the thing. And as a result, now I happen to believe that the U.S. should get out, dial itself down, and you know, perhaps work with the U.N., but our military presence there is ultimately not working. Other people will disagree with me. But no matter where you stand on the issue, the fact is that you come into the discussion with tremendously limited information, and that information is largely skewed by either a self-serving administration or tragedy, horror, awful things happening. All of that feeds into, I would suggest, poor decision-making and at the same time a tendency of an awful lot of Americans just to see it as a mess of a place that's unlikely to improve.
Ali, before we let you go, what are your thoughts on that? I've heard journalists in Afghanistan say that it is such a violent mess right now that if the U.S. pulls out and stops spending money on security forces, things will get worse. What's your take on it?
It's an issue, right? Because this was precisely the problem after the Cold War that we had, which was basically, you know, the U.S. funded this jihad against the Soviet occupation, which is, you know, brutal and oppressive and all of these things. But then what happened was after they had trained these people, they essentially extradited themselves from the situation, right? They completely ignored the country. We ended up in a civil war. From the civil war came the Taliban rule, and then eventually, you know, in 2001, the U.S. coming back in the last 17 years. So this is, amongst people who say, you know, that the U.S. should stay, this is the biggest fear, that it will be a repeat of that. And then, of course, you know, you also have, for instance, like we were talking earlier about sort of government statistics and what they really mean. We have the same problem here, because every day you hear reports that, oh, they killed this many Taliban or this many Daesh in this district or that district or this province or that province, and there's really no way to check up on that, right? There's really no way to tell who's dying, even though, you know, all of these attacks keep happening. And so in that case, then you do have people who say, like, okay, what have we seen really positively good come out of this foreign presence here? Or if they want to stay, then, you know, let them stay in terms of, like, aid workers, in terms of development and things like that. But militarily, what has really come of it? So the underlying issue is there's a fear. There is a fear that, and I think both sides will agree to it, whether they admit to it or not, is that there's a 50-50 risk in it, is that, you know, they pull out and, you know, things somehow eventually work itself out, or we end up in the repeat of the 1990s again. And that's really the fear that, you have people who are profiting off the war, you know, who want it to keep going because they're going to keep making money off of it.
Right.
But amongst the average person, those who fear the pullout, that's what they fear.
And Ali, of course, there's no way of knowing this, but many journalists say that ISIS would not be what it is today if the United States had not invaded Iraq. Do you think that Afghanistan would be dealing with this ongoing violence today if the U.S. hadn't invaded?
I mean, that's hard to say because, again, you know, we had sort of the same issue that we were talking about earlier in terms of the 1990s. I don't think it would necessarily be the same level of violence because the invasion of Afghanistan was what led to the invasion of Iraq, right, which led to the formation of Daesh. And So in theory, yes. But again, it's one of those things, it's very hard to know.
Right.
Because that was also the other frustration amongst the people, was that, you know, for all these years, the rest of the world looked on to what the Taliban was doing and did nothing until, you know, after 9/11.
John, we're going to stick with Afghanistan for just a couple more minutes. The Nation has written a number of articles about war spending, more than $1 trillion in Afghanistan. And if you look at Iraq, Syria, Homeland Security, all these other expenses, it could be up to $6 trillion or more. And your colleagues and you have written about why this doesn't get more attention. I mean, we ask this question on a regular basis. But what are your thoughts about this? I mean, the money just continues to flow. The contracts are given out on a regular basis with hardly any media coverage and hardly any public scrutiny at all.
Well, one of the things that was said about the British Empire, back when there was a British Empire, was that the evidence of its corruption, of its fundamental flaw, beyond the human cost of empire, was that it was so vast, it was so big, that no one could keep track of it. That the media of the time did not do a good job of keeping track of it, that the political elites did not. And so you had essentially outposts of empire for Britain around the world that were operated on the ground and operated by commercial interests effectively. Orwell wrote about this and others. I fear the United States has fallen into the same trap, that we have, not just in Afghanistan, but of course around the world, massive numbers of bases. We have immense amounts of spending that goes into them. All of this is integrated with, you know, private interests in a military-industrial complex, as Eisenhower referred to it. And there's just absolutely insufficient scrutiny of this. The media does not do the job we would like it to do. But neither does Congress. Neither do those in charge with oversight. So the end result is a very dangerous one, where we have things being done in our name as American citizens, with our money, but absolutely without our informed consent. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the worst of all circumstances, and it is writ large in Afghanistan, I believe.
John, quickly, we have an email from Mike in El Cerrito. Is it fair to say, he writes, with regard to Afghanistan, the public's attention span has waned, or is it more true to say that media editors' perception of the public's attention span has waned? How is the public's attention span measured on Afghanistan?
That is a superb question, right? Because we in the media cannot always make people follow a story, right? But what is absolutely clear is that if you invest a lot of resources in covering a story, and if you maintain that coverage, look for new elements of the story, look for nuances, look for exciting components, keep opening up issues, doing investigations, not just in Afghanistan, but also of all these defense contractors and all this money and things like that, that you can make the public quite interested in something,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
But if you don't do that, obviously the interest wanes. And so I think that the question is it hits the exact heart of the matter. It is my belief that when the United States is at war someplace, U.S. media has a responsibility to do pretty intensive coverage of that war.
Mm.
So that the American people can know whether they want to continue to support it. And the best way to circle back on this and answer the question at core is, in the 1960s and early 1970s, when U.S. media decided to cover the war in Vietnam intensively and did do so every day, there's simply no question. Everyone from Lyndon Johnson to Richard Nixon to Walter Cronkite to Noam Chomsky agreed that media coverage caused the American people to be incredibly uncomfortable with that war.
Mm. Ali, before we let you go, what are you working on right now?
Right now, something about when Donald Trump said that he doesn't want to negotiate with Taliban, about the idea of how this whole perception of negotiation with the Taliban has been very complicated, and how there have always been mixed messages from the government, from the U.S., from the Taliban. So trying to sort of explain that in a more analytical manner.
Well, Ali, thank you so much for joining us. We would love to have you back for a full show about Afghanistan. And thank you for your reporting. Ali Latifi is a freelance journalist joining us from Kabul, and you can check out one of his latest pieces, Heart of Darkness, where he interviews a number of people in Kabul about what their lives are like. I mean, the violence is just ongoing there, and you can find that at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after the break, we'll continue speaking with John Nichols, national affairs correspondent with The Nation magazine, and we'll be joined by Peter Stone, investigative reporter with McClatchy Newspapers, and we'll be talking about that White House declassified memo, the decision to declassify the memo, and the intelligence committee giving it to Fox and the Washington Examiner. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
You are listening to Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email yourcall@kalw.org or leave a comment on the website at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at Your Call Radio. Coming up at 11, it's 2 hours of 1A from WAMU in Washington, D.C., and at 2, a full hour of BBC News Hour Extra, and more on Afghanistan and the continued influence of the Taliban there. Stay with us if you can.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, it's our One Planet series. We'll be joined by Carrie Gillum, a journalist who wrote a new book called Whitewash, the story of a weed killer, cancer, and the corruption of science. She says that health experts around the globe recognize that pesticides like Monsanto's Roundup are a major contributor to a range of health problems, but by concealing the truth, they have put even more pesticides on the market. We're also putting shows together next week about renters' rights and medical, not medical marijuana, but the legalization of marijuana now in California, and social justice. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. Now we are going to talk about the news that we're just getting this morning. The White House has declassified a memo in which Republicans accuse the DOJ and the FBI of bias in the early stages of the Russia investigation. What is the real story here? John Nichols is national affairs correspondent for The Nation and author of Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. And now I would like to welcome Peter Stone to the show. Peter is a special correspondent and investigative reporter for McClatchy Newspapers, and he has been extensively covering the memo with his colleagues. Hi, Peter. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
It's great to have you, Peter. Peter, in your opinion, what is the real story here?
The real story is, at the moment, shrouded under a lot of partisan fighting, it seems. There's been an effort over the last several weeks to get this memo out, a concerted effort by the majority on the House Intelligence Committee, who have raised objections all along to many parts of the investigation into the Russia influence operations in 2016. The memo has been put together and released over strenuous objections from senior people at the Justice Department and FBI, who have raised public concerns in an unprecedented way that it can compromise parts of national security by releasing it the way they have. And it seems to be coming out in a way that is designed, obviously, to bolster some of the allegations from the White House and the administration that the investigation is biased. There are a lot of things in the memo that are unclear. Both the senior justice people and the FBI raised red flags about omissions and distortions that they saw in the memo based on a very cursory look that they got at it late just before it was sent over to the White House. And it does seem like a rush to get this out for political reasons. the memo does raise a lot of concerns, allegations that the early stages of the investigation contained some biases in the rather arcane area of obtaining a warrant to surveil one advisor to the Trump campaign. Those are some of the high points, but there are a lot more details which we can get into as we go along.
It was just declassified this morning. Have you had a chance to look it over, Peter?
I've only looked at it briefly in the last 45 minutes or so. I've tried to give you some of the details in it. It mainly focuses on questions about how the FISA warrant, which typically we've talked to people in recent days, former justice people, former FBI people, about the incredibly complicated process involved in getting a FISA warrant that has built-in protections quite a lot to make sure that these things are not issued in a way that is biased, and to make sure that these things typically are not issued without absolute scrutiny that the person who is being targeted justifies special scrutiny. The memo does suggest and state that the Steele dossier, the one that was commissioned originally by Republicans and then by Democrats, that was put out, that came out around the very end of the election period, that the Steele dossier was used as a key source, implies that it was used as a key source for obtaining the FISA warrant, and therefore they make the leap that it was therefore tainted. It's unclear how much the Steele dossier, though, was used as a key part of the application for the FISA warrant, which was October of 2016. There is background on the man, Mr. Page, who was, who the warrant was targeted. It's been reported widely that he was scrutinized back in 2013 when there were efforts by Russian operatives to enlist him as a spy. That's been reported in major publications. So there's a background there that was not mentioned in the memo today. Mr. Page also made a well-publicized trip to Moscow in the summer of 2016, several months before the FISA warrant on him was obtained. And he spoke publicly there in what many people think suggested was a way that was unusually critical of the United States and tilting toward Kremlin positions on various issues. So that context is certainly not there in the memo, and I think that's part of what the Democrats are upset about and that some of the national security people are upset about.
Peter Stone is a special correspondent and investigative reporter for McClatchy Newspapers. He and his colleagues have been writing about this memo. John Nichols is national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine. John, this is getting nonstop media attention. What do you think is the real story here?
Well, I think there's a couple of storylines that are really important, and I think Peter summed them up quite well. At core, you have a partisan fight. You have members of Congress who are really extensions of the White House. They are not serving an oversight role or a checking and balancing role. They are operating as agents of the administration to use their positions to force the release of information about an inquiry that the White House doesn't like. Now, there are times in history where the release of information about an inquiry or about government actions is very, very useful for the public discourse because it actually tells people some stuff that's going on that they didn't know about. I think as Peter well sums up, and as many other folks have, what we've really got in this memo, as best I can see, and I've looked through it briefly as well, is confirmation of a lot of stuff we know, and then some speculation about what Devin Nunes and some other people think was the motivation of people who were involved. There's some really over-the-top allegations in the memo, particularly as regards Christopher Steele and some other folks. But at core, I think it's a pretty thin piece of work here. And so while President Trump will certainly try to hang a lot of his arguments on this, and Devin Nunes and others, my sense is that this memo is not going to last for very long. I don't think it's going to have a lot of traction, because at least what we see here, unless Peter sees more, and I respect his good insights and work, I don't think there's enough here to really cause people to say that there shouldn't be inquiries, or frankly that people who are in key positions, such as Ron Rosenstein, should be removed.
Peter, what does this memo mean for the Mueller investigation? I mean, can you give us an update on the Mueller investigation?
Well, there's a lot on the latter part to talk about. Let's talk about first what it means, because that too is in play at the moment. I mean, the reports have been coming out for weeks now that President Trump is upset with Justice Department and some FBI decisions and some Justice Department and FBI personnel. We know that he's speculated about removing the Attorney General. There's been speculation about that. There have been lots of stories in the major publications about his displeasure with A.G. Sessions, even though he was one of his earliest supporters and has been a strong ally on many issues. He was furious that Sessions recused himself from the oversight of the Russian investigation because Sessions had contacts with the Russian ambassador, which he failed to disclose adequately. So Sessions, many months ago, removed himself. That left the oversight of the Mueller investigation in the hands of the number two man, Rod Rosenstein, who's a Republican, it should be noted. Obviously, Sessions was a Republican, too. And there was a report in the New York Times in recent days, I think I'm pretty sure it was the New York Times, that said that there was a conversation back in December that Rosenstein had with the White House, in which he was asked, "Are you on my team?" That echoes, some of the comments that the president made to former FBI director Mr. Comey before he fired him back last year. Anyway, the point is that there have been many signs that the memo may be used as a rationale for cleaning house and removing a couple of top people at Justice and or the FBI. President Trump, in his own statements today, was, very bold, very aggressive in fingering, the failures of top people, unnamed top people at FBI and Justice. So there's certainly a lot of indicators that we may be seeing more shakeups, efforts to shake up both departments, and the backdrop to that, or the rationale for that, as Trump would have it, would be this might be a way of slowing or hindering the investigations going forward. If he's charging political bias, then he might try to, remove people, force them out, fire them, and put new people in who he might see as potentially more checks on the Mueller investigation. There's obviously, it's been reported that he's, upset with the investigation, which he said from the beginning is a witch hunt and a hoax. The stakes in firing Mueller are enormously high and would also set off fireworks. So it's seen by many people, and other reporters have commented on this, that there may be another strategy underway here that would remove people who are, in line to oversee the Mueller investigation. Anyway, the memo will, I'm sure, have a lot of repercussions. Suspect it will have a lot of repercussions in coming days. Whether we see this kind of a shakeup is unclear, because it also could set off an even bigger political firestorm. And since the president is now, and the White House are reportedly being seriously looked at by Mueller in terms of potential obstruction of justice, there's got to be a lot of cost-benefit calculating going on in terms of how far they go in terms of trying to slow the Mueller investigation which is, you know, has certainly has a lot of risks.
John, what are your thoughts on the risks, the White House taking these risks, the Republicans who are supporting Donald Trump and declassifying this memo?
Well, I think the biggest risk is that of Paul Ryan. We know where Donald Trump's coming from, and we know how he fights his fights. It's very aggressively. He does fire people. He actually made his national name on television saying you're fired, and he has done so as president. He is also somebody who is who has a hard time controlling his emotions, his responses to those emotions, by all evidence. So we've got a good picture of him, and yes, I'm sure he is going to seek to play this out, at least in some ways. There'll be pressures and push and pull within the White House. There'll certainly be some people who try to constrain his response. We also know who Devin Nunes is. Look, this is a guy who was on the Trump transition team. He extends from Trump in every way. He's been surrounded by scandal, was sort of pulled back from his role with the committee and then stepped back into it. And so he's a pretty well-defined figure. But the key player here is Paul Ryan. Paul Ryan has reconstituted Devin Nunes as a major player in Congress. Paul Ryan authorized and supported the release of this memo. If Ryan had exercised restraint, if he had said, no, look, I just don't think this is the right thing to do. I don't think the House of Representatives should be doing this. There might still have been a push and pull. There's no question of that. But I think that the center of gravity would have gone to another place. What's happened here is that Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, has chosen a side in this thing. He has chosen to put the House of Representatives in the service of the executive branch, in the service of a sitting president. I think the consequences for him will long-term be very, very serious, politically, and frankly also for whatever is left of his reputation as a reasonable or responsible player. And I admit there's not much left of that, but I think this is very destructive for Ryan.
John Nichols is national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine, author of Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. You can find the show we did with John about his latest book at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined today by Peter Stone, special correspondent and investigative reporter for McClatchy Newspapers. Peter, you and your colleagues have written lengthy pieces about this memo and the investigation. And now the memo is classified, but so much of obviously what the House and Senate Intelligence Committees do are classified. How do you make sure that what you're reporting on is accurate, especially as politicians, the FBI, the DOJ, in many cases, use the media in different ways for PR? I mean, how are you sure that you're getting accurate information?
Excuse me, well, that's a good question. I think we have to be very, very careful, and we try to be very careful, going over sources on stories, requiring that sources have at least two sources in terms of information that we think is new and hasn't been disclosed. And, you know, we work a lot of different angles, talking to former government officials, current office holders. We try to get as wide an input, I mean, generally speaking now, on stories, sensitive stories, where we're disclosing new information. And, you know, obviously you have to be careful not to make mistakes, because the media is under a lot more scrutiny than it used to be. And, you know, it's being used as a punching bag more than it ever has been before by this administration. And so, you know, the White House delights in howling fake news on many fronts. So it does make it, you know, it does put a premium on, you know, being extra careful, extra, you know, taking extra steps on tough stories.
John, what would you add?
I really appreciate how Peter's is describing this. I think that's exactly right. Look, we're in a complex area here because there is so much spin, there is so much politics involved in all this, that I think we really have not just a divided country, as is well evidenced by polls and so many other measures, but also a country with divided attention. Democrats, allies of Democrats, critics of President Trump, even some of them Republicans, just believe that this memo is completely a political ploy, it's totally bogus, and frankly that all of the defenses of Donald Trump are ploys, that they're bogus, that there's an absurdity in all this. At the same time, Trump's allies, Republicans, people like Paul Ryan, but also some news outlets, run a completely different story, that Trump is a victim of a lawless deep state. And it becomes harder and harder for mainstream journalists to, you know, kind of walk between these two camps to say, hey, we should be concerned. It is valid to have debates about how FISA warrants are obtained, for instance. It's very important to have oversight of the FBI, of the Justice Department, of inquiries of this sort. People on the left and the right should share that view. And so, you know, let's take a look at what happened here. Let's give it its due. You know, suddenly that sounds like, oh, you're on Trump's side here, right? But no. What you're really trying to do is get to the bottom of the thing. Here's where I think we end up. It's hard for journalism, and it's hard for journalists in this time. The core job is to look at what's being put before you and try and bring at least some analysis to it. Don't just put the information out, right? But bring a good analysis of it. And this is hard because a lot of journalists don't like to do this, but at some point we have to say, this is bogus. This is silly. This is partisan. Let's toss it to the side. And that may sometimes involve things that come from Democrats as well as Republicans. But it's just, you know, as hard as it is, it's what you have to try and do is to get between those silos.
Mm. You know, Peter, John makes a great point, and it just reminded me of the reporters at McClatchy who received prizes for asking the critical questions about the United States' decision to invade Iraq that many other papers were not asking. Right now I'm just looking at a couple stories. The reporting team that got Iraq right, that's McClatchy. So what about John's point that sometimes reporters just have to say, this is bogus, or push back against the narrative, rather than allowing the Trump administration and the White House to frame the narrative?
Well, I think it does, you know, there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, it involves peeling back the onion on multiple levels, on spin, on disinformation, on just outright falsehoods. And if you read the front pages of our newspapers the last couple of years, there have been more stories than I've ever seen in 40-plus years of being a journalist about factual errors in statements by the president. I mean, it's just been it's been a kind of an unprecedented period where the New York Times, the Washington Post, and others are calling out factual errors. Now, that doesn't mean they get them all, or that they're getting them all right, but there's certainly, an unusual amount of evidence out there and information about misstatements. So I think that is important. I wasn't with McClatchy when they did those stories. They were very good. I noted them at the time. I also was skeptical about, you know, as a writer for National Journal back then, skeptical about the information that was being fed about the Iraq, you know, the origins of the Iraq war. I wrote a little bit about it. But it does require being independent-minded and being tough.
Peter, now that this memo has dropped, where are you and your colleagues planning to put your focus next?
Well, there'll be a lot of fallout for the next, you know, coming days. I mean, we may see an effort to shake up, you know, the Justice and FBI leadership, as I mentioned, and the White House appears to be, you know, sending signals that may be coming. Certainly they're going to make, you know, the rhetoric has been turned up on that to a much higher level. There have been a number of stories we've been working on, longer investigative stories, some of which have come out in the last few months, some of which are still in the oven that we're working on now, that deal with various parts of the Russia influence efforts in 2016 and various parts of the investigation. There are a lot of people under scrutiny, and we're trying to dig deeper into a few of them, and that's where we're heading.
And, John, top Democrats just came out with a letter warning Donald Trump that if he fires Mueller and Rosenstein, it would be an obstruction of justice.
Well, there's no question it would be. And, of course, that's, you know, coming from my perspective, I suppose there might be some people, obviously, who would say differently. But to my view, the obstruction of justice line was crossed a long time ago. I wrote a book on impeachment, a history of impeachment in the United States, and a history of efforts to hold presidents to account. Looked at every example of it going back to the days of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. And the bottom line is that our media today, and an awful lot of our political class, has very little sense of perspective, and frankly, very little sense of the constitutional dictates that have been in place since 1787. If you bring that to bear, if you look at the circumstance that we are in, there is simply no question that we're in an obstruction of justice moment. What's unsettling to me is, frankly, as regards to the Democrats, they use this term, obstruction of justice, but very few leaders in the Democratic Party then take it to the next appropriate step, which is to say that if the President of the United States were to remove these people, were to act in this way, then his actions merit immediate efforts to impeach him and remove him from office. That's not a radical statement. That's the statement that Congress made as regards obstruction of justice, at least the House of Representatives Judiciary Committee, with Richard Nixon some 40 years ago. And so I'm unsettled by the caution of many in the political class, and it also troubles me that many media outlets, most media outlets, reflect that caution rather than bringing a rational historical perspective to this and say, we're already there. I think newspapers, especially which still maintain editorial pages, should be editorializing in favor of the impeachment of the president at this point. And certainly if you were to do these firings, it would be absurd for them not to do so.
Wow. Well, we'll continue to follow this. John Nichols is national affairs correspondent for The Nation and author of Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. Peter Stone is a special correspondent and investigative reporter for McClatchy Newspapers. John and Peter, thank you for your work and thank you for joining us.
Great
thank
pleasure.
Thank you again. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.